Yeah, that's good. My name is Doug Rowell, and I am a very grateful alcoholic. I'm grateful to be an alcoholic and grateful to be a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. And the reason I say that is just to irritate the newcomers, I guess, you know. What do you mean grateful? Grateful to be an alcoholic? What kind of idiot are you? That's what I did. When I heard somebody say I'm a grateful alcoholic, it was like, that's the stupidest thing I ever heard, you know. Hey, yeah, thanks for the terminal illness, you know. I'm very grateful to be in Nashville, Tennessee, too. I've never been in Tennessee before, and I've always had a good feeling about Nashville and thought of someplace I'd always like to go, but I just never managed to get over here before. I've drank some of Tennessee. I'll tell you, if your sobriety is anything like your sour mash, and it is, it's it's good. I've been having some fun. I've been having nothing but fun since I got here. The minute that William picked me up at the airport, and we started talking and got me back here just in time to get checked into the hotel and come over here and hear Joe talk Thursday night. If you weren't here a Thursday night when Joe talked, get the CD, because he was great, you know, remind us a lot about selfishness and self-centeredness and the things that we need to focus on, and he does a great job of that. Interesting thing happened right after Joe's talk. Was over here this side of the room and talking to Butch and Scott from here. Butch is going to talk tonight. And Scott from around here, and a lady came up and was standing next to us, and I figured she's somebody from the committee telling me things I shouldn't do. You know, listen, we heard about you, and don't do this and don't do that. But you know, so as soon as Scott and Butch walked away, I said, "Hi, I'm Doug," and she said, "I know." So my friend Edie, who is a new friend, who told me. And I'm reluctant to share this because I don't want to make it sound like an ego trip. It's not at all. Edie told me that when she was brand new, she's been in the program 2 years, and when she was brand new, somebody thought she looked uncomfortable and gave her a CD and told her to listen to it, and she thought it was some kind of meditation music or something, but she was willing to do whatever could be done, and it was a CD of me. If you don't know, I'm like the AA clown, you know, I don't really, that's my message, you know, and she listened to it and got to laugh, and she told me she wore out that CD and had to get another one, and that I was special to her, and that kind of thing, it just touches me, you know. And I tried to tell her that I understand that, because I was new. And when I was new, I got a tape of a guy named Ken D, who some of you have heard and some haven't. But he was smart, and he was funny, and he was tough, and he had a great message of spirituality. And I wore out that cassette tape till the tape stretched. I had to get another one. So it's like exactly the same thing. And I heard him talk in person a couple of times after that. But this last May, I was at an AA function in Maui, and Ken was the Saturday night speaker, and I was able to spend a little time with him and go up and say, you know, that you touched me, that I wore out your tape, and you gave me what I needed to have when I was new. And he said, I got it from somebody else, you know. And that's what we do. You know, I mean, fortunately, I was 20 years sober, so I didn't, like, burst into tears and throw my arms around his neck, you know, like some people do. Edie right there in the second row. And love you too, Edie. now you have an obligation to pass this thing on to somebody else. You know, it was Ken that I first heard say one of the wonderful things that he said on this tape that I had of him early on was that he said, when I was a kid, I grew up in New York City, and they would take the class to the Statue of Liberty. And the Statue of Liberty has a spiral staircase that goes up, and they would have the kids hold hands so they couldn't get lost. And he said, I would be in the middle of the class, And I could see the person on either side of me, but I couldn't see the person at the beginning of the line going up the stairs or the person at the end. But I knew I was connected to them, and that's exactly what AA is. You know, and when I say I'm grateful to be an alcoholic, I am so grateful to be an alcoholic. I don't, as far as I know, I'm the only alcoholic in my immediate family, and I'd rather be me than any of them. And I know we have a lot of bad rap talk about our families around here, and there's nothing wrong with my family. My family is great. I grew up in this happy, loving, hard-working middle-class family in Orange County, California, and my mom came to hear me talk at a meeting one time, and I said that I didn't come from a dysfunctional family. And afterwards, we went out with some people to dinner, and she said, "I don't think you should tell those people you didn't come from a dysfunctional family." I said, "Do you think it was dysfunctional?" She said, "Well, it's okay after you left, you know." So. So it's, you know, it's like Clancy said, it's a disease of perception, you know. And I got to hear good speakers today. Liz, I'd never heard Liz B that talked last night. She knocked me out, you know, and I can hardly wait to hear her again. I told you, my friend Butch is talking tonight, gives a great talk, and my friend Kenna is talking tomorrow. Kenna comes from L.A., where I come from, and she gives great talks tomorrow. The two Al-Anon speakers that I heard, Rick yesterday was great. He's sponsored by my friend Mary Pearl, and I loved his talk, and today, listening to Penny. Penny was great. I mean, and you know, when she went through the steps and focused particularly on 6 and 7, which a lot of times, a lot of us, including Bill Wilson, kind of skipped over 6 and 7, you know, and I don't think Bill knew what he was writing when he wrote it, really. Because it's like you do all that other stuff, you know, admit that we're powerless and come to believe a power that greater than ourselves can restore us to sanity and make a decision to turn our will and lives over. And we do this inventory and write down all the wrongs and the defects that we've had in our life. And then we share them with somebody else. That gets us right to the gate, right to the gate, you know. And that's six, step six. Became entirely ready to have these things removed, you know, by God, and then humbly ask him to do so. That's serious stuff. That's where the program really kicks in. And I'm so glad that Penny, an Al-Anon, for Christ's sake, you know, was able to bring that to us. And I've just had a wonderful time here. William took me yesterday to see the Parthenon. I didn't know you had a Parthenon in Nashville. And it's a good one, too. The one in Greece doesn't even have a roof, you know. this is a really good one. It was great. They got an art gallery there. And then we went to, he took me, I said, when we were emailing, I said, he said, "Any place you want to go?" I said, "I don't suppose you have any guitar stores in Nashville, do you?" You know. So he said, "Yes." And he took me to a couple of them. And one of them was a Gibson store, which they have every kind of Gibson guitar there is. Yeah. Oh, thanks. And so I didn't buy one. I was going to buy one, but the one I really liked cost more than my car. And but I was playing a song for William, a song that I wrote in recovery, and sort of every once in a while I write a song that has something to do with recovery. And so he said, "You ought to do that one when you talk." I said, "No, you know, I didn't come here to sing songs, you know, twist a little harder." So this song is a song that I wrote, and it's sort of inappropriate. Not the song. The song's not inappropriate as much as it's just to sing at, you know, when you're supposed to talk, you know. And it's, I was 13 steps when I was 21 days sober, and... and I have no objections about it to this day. As a matter of fact, Matter of fact, she was the first one on my 13-step list that I was going to get around to, and she got around to me first, and we ended up, we were married for 15 years, you know, and so yeah, well, that's, we're not anymore. No, you know what happens, I mean, we went our separate ways. We, after 15 years together, we loved each other, but we just had different interests and decided not to be married anymore. And there was no fighting, no arguing, no stealing, no, you know, we just went our separate ways. We got divorced and it was happy. I'm grateful to Randy because she taught me great things in this program. She was sober 2.5 years when I was brand new. So she taught me, for instance, how to ask questions because I'm not a question asker by nature. You know, I something about me that says if you ask a question, they'll think you don't know the answer. And so I like to hang out with people that I think know the answer. And then if they ask the question, then I go, yeah, that's right. And but Randy taught me how to ask questions because we were in bed one night and I had my leg on her side of the bed and she grabbed my leg like a log, you know. I said, get over on your own side of the bed. God damn, you sleep like Jim Parks. I said, you know, I don't know any Jim Parks. And I understand she does, but I don't know why she would say that. It seemed... I know I was promiscuous when I was drinking and using. I know she was, and that's that. You know, there's no hostility, no resentments, except why would she bring it up in bed and say, I sleep like him. I slept with a lot of people who slept funny, but I don't say you sleep like him. You know, and so I'm laying there. I'm working on a resentment. I'm sober long enough to know I'm working on a resentment. I even know some of the things I can do about it. I'm not going to get up and write about it in the middle of the night, but I do know that if I hang on to this thing and don't say anything, pretty soon I'm going to be wearing it. And, you know, and like 3 days later, she's going to say to me something like, did you mean to leave your boots in the dining room? You know, and I'm just like, ping, you know, boots my ass. Hey, boot down on this bitch. Who's Jim Parks? You know, so... Yeah, you know. So, I know if I don't say something, I'm in trouble, and so I have to ask a question. And I did. I said, "I'm sorry, honey. Am I supposed to know who Jim Parks is and how he sleeps?" And she starts laughing at me. She's a cackler, you know. You know Jim across the street? Jim across the street. She said, yeah, you know how he puts his truck so you can't park in front of him or in back of him without blocking the driveway? Yeah, you sleep like Jim Parks. And so... You can learn some stuff asking questions, you know. I was in a meeting yesterday morning here. The subject was God as we understood him, understand him. So, of course, that was the only thing nobody talked about. No, that's not true. But a woman named Sherry talked about being 13-step in a recovery house that she was in, And they're together 25 years, you know. So 13 steps aren't... But she, like I, doesn't let her babies, you know, 13-step. Because, you know, you may not get as lucky as we are. But this is a song that I wrote called 13-Step Tango. There's a burning desire, love and service to share. And practice these principles in some lurid affair. No matter how low your bottom, when your drinking is through, in AA we guarantee it. There's a nut here to fit every screw. And we come in with nothing tangible, lives unmanageable and mangled. Soon as we're sober and clean, we do the 13-step tango. Across a crowded room, love will draw your attention. And you'll know that this time it must be divine intervention. Your sponsor may tell you that's a slippery soiree, not to listen to your libido. But what do they know anyway? Hey, you may be the exception to the general rule, but the truth is you're probably just some lust-driven newcomer fool. And you come here with nothing tangible, lives unmanageable and mangled. Soon as we're sober and clean, we do the 13-step tango. Hey, you know what I mean. Come do the 13-step tango. Yeah. Okay, it was inappropriate, but I it was fun for me, and I when I first came to my first AA meeting, I knew I was an alcoholic. People told me I was an alcoholic, and people who should know told me I was an alcoholic, and I believed I drank like an alcoholic. So, but I was pretty sure I was a different kind of alcoholic than you guys were, the kind of alcoholic, for instance, that had to stop drinking, you know. and I had a feeling that I was the kind of alcoholic who could drink appropriately, you know what I mean? Who could have a cold beer on a hot day, say, a glass of dry red wine with a steak, a margarita with a Mexican meal, you know what I'm saying? Or sometimes just like go get a fifth of whiskey and chug it down and have an inappropriate experience. But not all the time, you know. I seemed like I was having unexpected, inappropriate experiences, and I was getting in trouble with people who cared about me. And I had a couple of friends who had gotten sober, a man and a woman. They weren't together. They were just friends that I drank and used with, and they both had gotten sober in the same year. And I noticed, you can't help noticing, if somebody's working any kind of a program, you notice. If you know these people while they're drinking, that they start like showing up on time, you know, where they say they're going to be when they say they're going to be there, and dressed appropriately, and speaking in whole sentences, and I was impressed with that. So I thought, well, I think I'll go to AA, and nobody was telling me to go to AA. There were people I understand now that were praying that I would, but I thought, I'm going to go check out AA, and for one thing, see for it, if I ever get really bad, I'll know where to go and what to expect. And also, maybe I can kind of glean the principles, the gist of this thing, and use whatever it is that you do to stop drinking and apply it to my seriously cutting down. You know, so I went to my first meeting. It was a pretty good size Friday night speaker meeting in Van Nuys, California, at the Valley Presbyterian Hospital. And it was a nice subterranean carpeted room where they had a stage, and people were laughing and hugging, you know, and it's okay, they hug and laugh, you know, and people were trying to get me to sit down. I didn't want to sit down because I had a feeling if I sat down, everybody, hey, he's all right, he's joining up, you know, so... I just sort of stayed leaned against the wall in the back, you know. It's like they had double doors like this, and I was on one side of the door leaned against the wall, and another guy was leaned against the wall on the other side of the door. We were like the cool section, you know. We were and we were so cool we didn't even talk to each other. We were like And so people would come up, hey, you want to sit down? There's some seats over there. No, and I'm watching. I'm a figure outer. You know, I get this thing. People come in, they sit down a purse, sit down a coat, sit down some keys. No purse, no keys, no coat. I can sit there. It's an open chair. I get it. I'm a smart guy. You know, the deal is, I may not be able to stay around. You know, I'm a busy guy, and you know what I wish they had had then? It's so cool now, like Bluetooth. And Bluetooth, you know, there's nothing that says I'm a very important guy. I may get a call and have to leave, like a piece of flashing jewelry. You know, So they didn't even have cell phones when I got so. I mean, they had mobile phones, but they were in briefcases, and only rich people had them. And people had pagers, though. I didn't have a pager. Nobody wanted to contact me. There's no point in them. But I had gone to a thrift shop and got a garage door opener with a clip on it. You know, and I'd wear it on my belt, and if my drink alarm went off or I just got tired of talking to you, I go, I got to get this. And so I was impressed. Everybody's telling me keep coming back. You know, they didn't even know me, and they're telling me. People who knew me didn't tell me keep coming back. That's the interesting thing. People who knew me would say things like, don't come over here. You know, Hey, it's Doug. Are you guys going to be home? Because I'm going to come over and visit you. And they get, no, we're not, Doug. We're just walking out the door, man. I don't know how long we'll be gone. A long time, though. Yeah, don't come over here. Okay, love you, Mom. And you know, I got uninvited to a wedding. I got uninvited to a friend's wedding. My friends were getting married, and they invited me. They sent me an invitation. I RSVP'd. You know, yeah, I'm coming. I got them a wedding present. I wrapped it, set it in the table. It's like Thursday night, the wedding. Saturday morning, I get this call. Hey, Doug, it's Bob. Hey, Bob, what's up, man? How's Carol? She's good. You guys nervous? Yeah. Yeah, that's why I called. Listen, we were talking about it, and we'd like for you to not come to the wedding. And I some people would be offended by that, and I wasn't even curious. I got it. I was like, hey, good idea, you know. Because I don't know how it is really in Tennessee, but in California, some people think weddings are like a really big deal, and So we had all been at a wedding the weekend before, and well, I mooned the bride's mother, and I didn't go there to moon the bride's mother. I went to celebrate this matrimony, you know. But It was like a dance. It was like a dance like last night, you know, and everybody was having a big fun, and I was standing there watching, and all of a sudden my head said, you know what would be funny is to show your ass. And it seemed like a great idea, you know. This is going to crack them up. And it just happened to work out. It was right when the music stopped, you know. So, and I go, hey! And man, you could have heard a pin drop. And I wish you guys had been there, because you see the sense of humor in it, you know. But and these people were friends of mine. The whole, you know, almost everybody there was a friend of mine. It wasn't like, who was that strange guy? They knew who I was. And I see the bride's mother happened to be standing there. I wasn't aiming at her. I didn't. She just happened to be right there. And so a couple of friends of mine grabbed me and dragged me out in the alley behind and said, geez, Doug, God damn, man, you mooned the bride's mother. I said, excuse me. And I thought it was the groom's mother. Hey, come on, lighten up, man. You know, it was just, it was humor, okay? It was humor, all right? I mean, get a smile. Jeez, I didn't do it in the ceremony. Was at the reception, for Christ's sake. What am I, an animal? And so they gave up on me. They just said, one guy said, Doug's Gusting. And that, so people called me Doug's Gusting for years after that. So when I came to AA and people were nice to me and said, keep coming back. And, are you new? And, you're the most important person in the room. Yeah, I get that. I'm surprised you recognize me. So I leaned against the wall in the back and me and this other cool guy and watched what was going on. And I know that somebody spoke that night because I was there for the whole meeting. But it's a speaker meeting, but I don't know. I couldn't tell you if the speaker was a man or a woman. So what I remember is they said, now, maybe I don't know in Tennessee if you call them birthdays or anniversaries. I know most of the country called celebrations of years of sobriety anniversaries. But in Southern California, it's Hollywood. It's like, hey, a birthday! And so they said, we have a birthday tonight for Ruth for 18 years. And everybody, yay, Ruth! So I'm, oh, that's cool. They celebrate people's birthdays. And so I'm looking around for Ruth, some 18-year-old tiny hiney, And I said, where's Ruth? And I look around. Ruth gets up, man, and she is 50 if she's a day. And holy cow. If she's 18, she really should stop drinking. And I told you I'm a figure outer, and the woman didn't look bad. She looked great. She looked terrific. I mean, she was made up and coiffed and dressed, to come and take her birthday cake. So I thought she is 50. She's at least 50, and this is AA. They don't drink here. Okay, I get it. She hasn't had a drink in 18 years. God, 18 years. It's probably a national record, No wonder they're so excited about it. And 18 years, she couldn't have drunk like I did. And so she gets up, and these three younger girls come out with this cake with these candles blazing. And then everybody, 200 people, start singing happy birthday. I'm talking about 200 people singing at the top of their lungs in four different keys at the same time. Happy birthday. And many of them were not even committed to the key they started in, And I'm like, and I have a musical background. I'm like, oh, my God, these people need help. And they had a piano up on the stage, and it was covered up with a sheet. And I thought, 200 people, somebody here plays piano well enough to play Happy Birthday. And I really thought, maybe I can help them, run up there and grab this. Just a minute. Grab that sheet off. Here I come to save the day, okay, in the key of G, Happy Birthday. But I already told a lot of people I wasn't staying, so I got no lines. And that's a short song. I can handle it. And they finish, Happy Birthday, keep coming back. Man, this is a level of lameness I never imagined existed. And then Ruth comes up to the thing and she says, I'm Ruth, I'm an alcoholic. And everybody is like, hi, Ruth. Like, oh God, I'm so embarrassed for you guys, And then Ruth says, I want you to know that over these last 18 years of sobriety, I've attended a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous every single day. And people there were, a lot of people were, oh, wow. Oh, she does every day. Yes, she does. Everybody's like, there was nobody who wasn't impressed with that except me. I'm in the back going, what? Every day for 18 years. See, I'm a quick study. I don't know how long it would take me to get this deal if I want it, but I know it's not going to take every day for 18 years. I'm like a hum a few bars and I'll fake it kind of guy, And so I had this vision of Ruth walking home to her home every night and her husband going, hi, honey, how was the meeting? I got to go back tomorrow. and so I mean, I'm sort of entertaining myself. And then the other cool guy, turns out he's not even cool. I don't know why he's back there. Maybe he's got the newcomer catcher commitment or something. But he comes over to me and he says, hey, I'll tell you what. You stay sober a year, we'll give you one of them cakes. See, now, and I don't know what you guys were like when you came to your first meeting, but to me it was like, don't drink for a year, and I get a cake. Oh, boy. Well, you know, I mean, we're nothing without our goals, but you know, but I knew the guy meant well. He was a sweet guy, and he looked like a hippie. I could relate to him, and I didn't want to insult him, so I said, I'm not much of a pastry eater. If I really wanted a cake, I'd just stop at Safeway on the way home. You know, I think they're like $5, you know. Or I could not drink for a year. So that was my first meeting. Oh, and that first meeting, too, the secretary held up this book. And she said, this is our big book, Alcoholics Anonymous. And she said, if you're new tonight, please don't leave without this book. So I was new. And they had a bunch of them stacked up on a table with some other literature. And I thought, I'll steal the book, you know. I'm not. In fact, I even had a plan. I don't know how much it costs, but I figure if I pick it up and act like I'm fascinated with this book is obviously important to these people. So if I go, wow, this is great. This is really going to help with my sobriety, you know. I walk right out the door, and I think they would have let me go. I was convinced, and I still think they would have let me go. But the secretary screwed that up because she said, if you're new tonight and you're financially embarrassed, believe me, we understand that. We've been there. We want you to have this book, so we'll make very liberal credit arrangements, including nothing down and nothing a week until you get back on your feet. So now if I steal the book, you know, they're going to go, is this guy cute or what? He's stealing the book and it's free. And I'm not cute. I'm cool. So I got to buy the book or they'll think I'm not on my feet. So I went up to her after. I had to stay through the whole meeting. I went up to her after the meeting. I said, can I buy one of those books? And she said, yeah, the big book. Yeah, the big book. It seemed bigger. How much is it? And she said, it's $4.65. Do you have it? Do I have $4.65 for a hardcover book? Yeah, I think I can handle that. Yeah. Here's a $5. Keep the change. She said, I'll get you a change. No, keep that. Use that to help a drunk. I'm on my feet, you know. So I got this book and I took it home. And I got home and I said, okay, well, let's check out the book and see what's going on with AA. She had said that it was the only authority on AA. It was the basic text of the program. So here it is. It's all in the book. So I sat down with it. I picked up a fifth of whiskey on the way home, and I poured a shot, and I started to read this book. And not study read it, but like kind of read, you know, kind of skim it, you know, see what's in it. Some of it I didn't have to read. For instance, there's a part in the first part that's called Doctor's Opinion. I didn't need to read that because I've had doctor's opinions, and I know what they're like. Boy, you ought to not drink so much, you know. So next, chapter one, Bill's story. Who cares? Chapter two. Chapter two, there's a solution. I'm on a roll, dude. There's a solution is a sales pitch. I was raised on television. I recognize them a mile off, you know. Young man, there's a solution to your problem. The 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous will give you a life beyond your wildest drunken dreams. Next, chapter three, more about alcoholism. Ooh, now more about alcoholism sounds absolutely fascinating. It's a text on the disease I've been studying all my life. Chapter four, we agnostics. Okay, We Agnostics got my attention because I didn't expect to find a chapter called We Agnostics at all. I was shocked. The first meeting I went to, there's only a couple of things I didn't like. I liked the hugging and laughing. I believe that most of the people there drank like I did because I had friends that got sober. I believe that they didn't drink anymore. But a couple of things I had, there was the not drinking for extended periods that seemed excessive to me. And then there was a lot of God stuff. It was an awful lot of God stuff. I didn't expect any God stuff. I really believed that AA was the secular way to get sober without God. Nobody ever told me that, obviously, because this couldn't be farther from the truth. But my grandmother didn't much care for AA, and she had been an alcoholic who found Jesus and became a minister. She was a Pentecostal minister, and she opened a Skid Row mission in San Pedro, California, on Beacon Street. If anybody in here knows Beacon Street in the 1950s, Beacon Street was a nasty place, and you could get killed there almost any night just walking down the street. And it was full of saloons and hawk shops and shooting galleries and my grandmother's little white dove mission. And she would pull these wharf rats and winos off, come make a joyful noise and save their souls. And along with their saving their souls, they would also stop drinking. So I knew you could get sober on soup and Jesus. I had seen that done. But consequently, I thought AA was how the smart people got sober without God. So when I went there and I heard all this, you know, God as we understand him and power greater than yourself, and humbly asked him with a capital H and admitted to God and God. And I was, no. These 12 steps I've heard of so long are just chock full of God. And I was so disappointed. And then when I'm reading this book that's supposedly the only authority on AA, it's got a whole chapter called We Agnostics. So I thought, okay, here it is. This is how the smart people do it without God. So I poured a shot of whiskey and I read chapter 4 all the way through. And when I finished, I thought, all right, I'm spacing out here. I missed the whole smart people stay sober without God thing. So I poured another shot and I read it again. And it's like a lot of science stuff in there, you know, and the prosaic steel girders and the electrons whirling around. And they talked about the Wright brothers. But it really wasn't about how to stay sober without God. So I poured another shot, read it again. I did this 6 times that night. And I think 6 shots of whiskey slowed down my brain to the part where I could focus just on the black part. And I had to read more carefully some of the stuff that's actually in there got into my brain. There's a sentence in there that is incredibly significant, and yet it's worded so subtly that I don't think most of us realize at first how significant it is. It says, "We found that God doesn't make too hard terms on those who seek him." That is remarkable. What's remarkable about it to me is, I don't know if you've heard that before, but I haven't. I never heard that anywhere. I came in here openly hostile to every sect of every organized religion on the planet that I knew about. Openly hostile. And here's this chapter, this sentence that says, "We found that God doesn't make too hard terms on those who seek him." And, you know, my grandmother's Pentecostal church never suggested that. Now, anything I say about organized religion, I'm talking about my drunken opinion of organized religion, not necessarily what the facts, but it seemed to me that the people of my grandmother's Pentecostal church said, you know, Doug, they call me Doug. They said my name in less than a syllable, Doug, you know. Doug. "We are very sure that God makes hard times on those who seek him. You know, boy, God will not even hear your prayers unless you are baptized. And I don't mean sprinkle on the forehead like some Methodist, son. I'm talking about the total submission. That's why we got this tank of water for Christ up here. Come on up here, son. We're going to soak you down, pull you up, washed in the blood of the Lamb. Praise Jesus, all men. Somebody get the boy a towel." You know, I'm sorry. And I tell you, 14 years old, you know, and I figured it out. You know, they're going to drown me. She told them, I touched myself. They're going to send my ass to Jesus tonight. And I'm like, oh, you know, I have brand new jeans on. They're shrink to fit. You know, I wouldn't be able to ride my bicycle home. So I'll come back next week and wear something a little more water soluble. You know, y'all have a joyful noise now. And so... but it was just the Pentecostals, you know, you could go, okay, well, Pentecostals are a little over the top. But it seemed to me every sect of every religion. My girlfriend was a Catholic. She had to go to confession, communion, confirmation, a bunch of other cons, so she could learn how many Hail Marys and Our Fathers were required to cleanse her soul of the various kinds of... And they got various kinds of sins. They got them categorized over there. They, venial and menial and cardinal and mortal, and some of them you don't even have to do if you think about them. Expressway to hell, buddy, you know? So it's like, woohoo! Okay, they're tough, and... I go to church with her and her family. I went once, but I didn't get the, you know, I didn't stay long enough to learn all this stuff, you know, because like, I thought they were going to the holy water when they walked in like that, but I said, don't do that. And, you know, I'm sitting with them in the pew, and I thought they were standing up, so I stood up. No, they're kneeling. Oops, I'm kneeling. They're sitting. I feel like the middle cylinder on a three-cylinder Indian. It's like that question-asking thing. You know, I can't go back there and be humiliated in that God's house, you know, so I'm not going back there. But they were happy to do all that stuff, although they do it and still couldn't talk to God. You know, she talked to God's mom. Hello, Mrs. God, it's Julie. No, don't wake him. Just tell him I love him. Okay, bye. So I never got that. And my friend Michael was an Orthodox Jew, and I like going over to Michael's house. He and his brother had to wear spit curls to school, and they took a little heat for it. You know, it seems like there'd be a lot more Orthodox Jewish prize fighters, but I guess they learned to live and let live or something. But I like going over there. Mrs. Rothberg would come over, you know, and say, "Doug, welcome to our home. It's an honor to have you. Would you like to join us in some wine and challah?" Some what? Would you like to join us in some wine and challah? Well, I'll have some wine. Yeah, I'm not much of a pastry eater, you know. Mike and I were at this little mom-and-pop restaurant one time, and he says to the waitress, they had a small menu, he says to the waitress, "Can I order the BLT, hold the bacon?" And I'm, "Mike, you know what a BLT is?" It's like bacon, lettuce, and tomato. You hold the bacon, that's a salad on toast, you know? So I know, but I can't eat pork. "What? Can't eat pork. How come?" "Well, to consume the flesh of the cloven-hoofed animal that cheweth not its cud is to offend he whose name cannot be uttered." Say that again. That was American. That wasn't even Yiddish. What did you say? "Pork. Can't eat pork. That's all. Why not?" "Because it will offend he whose name cannot be uttered." "Who's that?" "Can't say his name." "Jesus Christ, no, but your clothes," he said. And then there were Buddhists and Hindus and Muslims. Oh, my, you know, so I just like, hey, I'm done, man. I'm done. At some point, I just said, okay, here's the line. All the religions of the world on that side of the line, I'm over here making fun of them. That's comfortable to me. That's my comfort zone. So that's the guy that came to AA. But now I'm looking through this book, and I get, we found, not we suspect, we found, this is our experience, that God doesn't make too hard terms on those who seek him. It goes on to say, find a God you're comfortable, a concept of God that you're comfortable with. Here's what it says. Some people who are overeducated will say that this book is, that the language is archaic and that it's poorly written. the efficiency in the words in this book, the more you study it, the more surprising it is, the more impressive it is. There's the sentence following, we found that God doesn't make too hard terms, says, you don't have to accept anyone's concept of God. You don't have to accept anyone's concept of God. Find one that you're comfortable with, and that seems to be fine with the creator of the universe. I never heard that anyplace else. I'm not saying it doesn't exist anywhere else. I've heard people who are much smarter than me about books and literature who say that chapter 4, We Agnostics in the big book, Alcoholics Anonymous, is the most important piece of spiritual literature in the English language in the 20th century. That's a very impressive endorsement. I have no idea if it's true because I don't know enough about English literature, of spiritual English literature of the 20th century, but it is to me. It is to me. And there's other stuff in that chapter that, like, for instance, to be doomed to an alcoholic death or to live life on a spiritual basis are not easy alternatives to face. You know why we're going, because we're alcoholics. Yeah, see, try this at the Grange meeting. It turns out, or PTA, most people think this is kind of a no-brainer decision. In fact, get yourself a clipboard and go stand in front of a Walmart sometime. Stop people when they're coming out. Excuse me. Taking a survey, would you rather die an alcoholic death or live a spiritual life? you might be surprised how many earth people just go, am I on candid camera? Yeah, I'll take the spiritual deal. They'll go get in the long line every time. You know, if you find one of us, excuse me, alcoholic death or spiritual life, and you get this. Ooh. You going to be here tomorrow? Yeah. Only here. Only in the place where I wasn't going to fit. Where I told you all I wasn't going to fit, and it's the only place I ever fit in my life. I didn't fit in my own family. I didn't fit in the workplace. I didn't fit in school. This is the only place I ever fit, and it's the hardest I ever worked at telling you how I wasn't going to fit. I had to go back to a meeting. There was something at the meetings that attracted me. I went back to the meeting, and I listened to what people were saying, and I went home, and then they say anybody with less than 30 days, alcoholic, and I go back, and then I think about it, and then I go back the next day and go at a 5:30 meeting and then an 8 o'clock meeting. My first 8 months in AA, I didn't do very much right. I didn't have a home group. I went to meetings all over Hollywood and the San Fernando Valley. And I didn't really want anybody to get to know me, but I wanted to see what was going on here. So I didn't have a home group. I didn't have a sponsor. I didn't read the book. I didn't take the steps. I didn't know what a tradition was. I didn't have a commitment. I didn't believe in God. And I was drinking every day. Okay. Yeah, but aside from that, I had a pretty good program, which was keep coming back. That was my whole program, and so I did that, and I would, one day I had been going to, for maybe, I don't know, 2.5 months, I think, maybe 10 weeks, I would raise my hand. Anybody with less than 30 days, Doug, alcoholic. Anybody has 30 days, less than 30 days since their last drink, Doug, alcoholic. Any new friends with us with less than, Doug, alcoholic. And I got tired of it, And so one day I was at the San Fernando group, 5:30 meeting, and it's one of those table meetings. People are sitting around tables, and they said, anybody with less than 30 days? And I started to automatically raise my hand, and I thought, it's none of their damn business. Really, it's humiliating, and I'm not gonna play that damn game anymore. I'm done. So I didn't raise my hand. Some girl at the end of the table mistook my arrogance for serenity or something, and said to her friend, "Doug's got 30 days." And I heard that. I wonder how she knows my name, Doug alcoholic, So I didn't want to make her look bad because she was on my 13-step list. So I took a 30-day chip. And, man, they went crazy. They're like, yay, Doug. All right, Doug. Yay. And I'm like, oh, it's nothing, you know. Yeah, it's nothing. You know, I sit down and, but now I got a sobriety date 30 days before my first bogus chip. So I was taking, chips all over now, you know, and then sometimes for some reason I would change my sobriety date at some meeting. Either they smelled whiskey on me or some girl would say, I can't have sex till I'm sober 6 months. So I take a 6 month chip over there and, fact is, I couldn't have scored in a women's prison with a pocket full of pardons, you know, but just in case. And so here's what happened. One day I came home from a meeting. It was an 8:30 meeting. It was over 10 o'clock. I came home, got a bottle of whiskey. I laid on the floor with the TV on and drank until I passed out. And no doubt thought about what I'd been hearing at meetings. I did that a lot. And there was a part of me that thought, you know, I surely am going to stop drinking sometime, but I couldn't imagine. The book says we can't imagine life with or without alcohol, and that was really it. I couldn't imagine life without alcohol, but I was lying to everybody, including people who would rather I drank, that I was sober. I had to drink by myself, and it was pretty lonely, but I couldn't give it up. And this one night, I woke up about 3 a.m., the bottle of whiskey's half full. I turn off the TV, I got my bottle, I crawled on my hands and knees across my living room and through the hallway into the bedroom to go. Some people call that kind of activity pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization, you know. I just called it going to bed, you know. Actually, I remember the first time I thought of it, I said, hey, can't fall off the floor. And this night I crawled into my bedroom and I stood up to get undressed and I lost my balance. I fell. I fell on my knees and I spilled this whiskey all over the bed and I picked up the bottle. There was some left in the bottle, but most of it was in the bedspread. So I set that bottle in a safe place and I grabbed that bedspread and I started sucking whiskey out of the bedspread. And a voice in my head said, hey man, that ain't right. You thirsty, man? There's whiskey in the bottle. No, I'm not thirsty. I'm, you know, frugal. I'll waste my life, but I'm not the kind of guy to let whiskey evaporate in the bedspread overnight, you know, so. But I looked at my life, what I was doing. I've been going to AA for 8 months, and I haven't learned how to not suck whiskey out of a bedspread. Maybe I'm a hopeless loser. Maybe I am. Maybe I'm a hopeless loser. I have no evidence to the contrary. When you have that thought, maybe I'm a hopeless loser, and you have no evidence to the contrary, I felt lost and alone. I didn't know what to do. And I did a dumb thing. I said, God, if you're there, please help me. And you know what I've heard the speaker say tonight? Joe said it Thursday night. Liz said it last night. God, help me. God, please help me. Mine was, God, if you're there, please help me. And I meant it, and I did not believe for one second there was anybody listening. I just did it. You know, we find out around here that our actions are much more important than our intentions. And I went to bed, and I went to sleep. And over the next couple of weeks, interesting things happened to me. The next day, I went into my neighborhood liquor store. There could only have been one of three people behind the counter day or night. And all of them would have recognized me and know what I came for. I walked in there the next day, and there's a guy from AA behind the counter. And I've been lying to these people, you know. So I said, hey, what are you doing here? And he said, what are you doing here? I just came to get some smokes, you know, and I got my cigarettes, and I went someplace else, got a bottle. And then But every day, weird things are happening. I'm in the Vaughn's supermarket in the liquor department. I reach up for a bottle. Somebody from AA is pushing a cart towards me. Hey, one day at a time. Keep it simple. That's a beautiful life, isn't it? You know, I was working a day over at Burbank, working over at NBC, and across from NBC is a big Mexican restaurant. So I went over there for lunch by myself, and I start to order a margarita, and the waitress is somebody I know from an AA club. Hey, how you doing? You know, it's good to see you. You'll never know how good it is to see you. And You know, but this is happening all the time. And I'm, after a couple of weeks of this, I'm on the way to work one morning at 6:30 in the morning. I just killed a half pint of Bushmills. By the way, these little incidents did not keep me from drinking. Sometimes I give the wrong impression. They are hurdles that a practicing alcoholic will have to jump over and is only too glad to jump over if there's a drink on the other side. But after a while, you can't help noticing them on a daily basis. So I'm on the way to work at 6:30 in the morning, and I got this half pint of Bushmills. I just emptied it, and I don't keep empty bottles in the car. They're illegal in California, and they're useless. And so I roll down the window, and I toss this bottle out in the street, and just as I let go of it, a guy from AA is driving towards me at 6:30 a.m. And he saw me, and he waved, and then he watched this bottle go in front of his car. Ding, 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 ding. I saw him kind of glance back, and I thought, where the hell are these people coming from? This is not fair. You know, this is like those stupid miracles they talk about in the meetings. And as soon as I thought the word miracle, it was like, sort of like I could hear God laughing, you know? God sound like Morgan Freeman when he laughs, you know? You know. Pulled the car over to the side of the road, and I sat there and listened to my heart. And I thought about being on my knees and saying, God, if you're there, please help me. And clearly from that moment, I started to get the help that I needed. I believe there's a correlation. I can't prove it, and I don't have to. Interesting things happened after I said that prayer on a daily basis. Maybe they were miracles. Maybe they were coincidences. There's a miracle involved. If nothing else, the miracle of my recognizing it that morning, that I asked for help and I got help, and I came to believe. I sat there in that car and parked on the side of the road that morning, and I came to believe that a power greater than myself could restore me to sanity. And it was the beginning of my sobriety, and it was the beginning of my hearing the music of Alcoholics Anonymous. So I'm loving coming to the Music City Roundup, you know, because I talk about the music of Alcoholics Anonymous all the time. It's so important to me. You know, there's a rhythm and a harmony and a melody that runs through this thing that makes the words make sense, you know. And your theme, what we'll find a new freedom and a new happiness. You know, that's exactly what happened. And I started to get this thing. I started to hear the music, and the words didn't make me crazy anymore. Things like surrender to win and give it away to keep it, you know. And some people say you have to die to live. Oh, my God, you know. And even in the big book, you know, that it's supposed to be sacrosanct. In one part it says on one page, with regard to alcohol, we're placed in a position of neutrality. And then in the very next page, same paragraph, it says, when tempted by alcohol, we recoil as from a hot flame. You know, so I'm sorry. Is it a hot flame, or am I neutral to it? Because I have feelings about hot flames, and you know, people. But that's all my head making up reasons, you know, and I wasn't hearing the music. When you start to hear the music, this is my favorite example of the music and the words. When I had 30 days of sobriety, I went over to the Burbank group. They have chip and cake night on Thursday night, and my 30 days happened to fall on Thursday. So I went over to the Burbank group. Now, I had taken a lot of different bogus chips there, and I was a little bit afraid people wouldn't believe me, but I really wasn't. I didn't care, really. Because I knew it was true, and my new friend God knew it was true, and that's really all that matters. They said, anybody for 30 days? I got up and I took a 30-day chip. I said, my name's Doug, and I'm an alcoholic. And he said, hi, Doug. And I said, I'm. And I watched people take 60-day chips and 90-day chips and 6 months and 9-month chips and a 3-year cake and a 7-year cake and a 19-year cake. And I was just as excited about everybody else's progress as I was about my own. And I recognize it, and that's not who I am. Intrinsically, I'm not somebody who's going to have a good feeling about somebody's progress who's ahead of me, you know. But that night I was, I was this high on the feeling of being sober and being a member of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I went to get coffee at the coffee break, and a guy stopped me over there, and he said, "Hey, congratulations on your 30 days." I said, "Thanks." And he said, "You know what the secret is?" That I don't drink, I guess, you know. We don't drink. And he said, no, that we don't drink, but that's not the deal. The deal here is hang on, man. That's what we do. Can you do that? So that's what I've been doing. Exactly. So keep doing that. be all right. That's the secret. And so, okay, they tell you the secret when you get 30 days. I'm looking for some newcomer to screw up. I mean, to share my experience, strength, and hope with. And before I could hurt anybody, there's a guy at Burbank named Jim Baker. He just died last month, and he was an old timer. He was a Southern born, glad handed, back slapping alcoholic, you know. And he would come up, hey son, you know. He came up and said, son, congratulations on that 30 days. I said, thanks. He said, you know what the secret is? I said, yep. Hang on. No, he said, let go. yeah, let go. That would have sent me right out to the liquor store, you know, before I started to hear the music. But I get it. I get it. The old timers are diametrically opposed to what the secret is. There's no secret here. You know, that's the secret. There's no secret. The guy who said, hang on, is talking about stay close. Keep coming back, you know. They told me stick around in the middle of the herd. Don't get around the perimeters and get picked off by the predators. Simple stuff. Jim B. that told me, let go is talking about let go and let God. Surrender. You know, they told me the war is over, son. You lost. You know. That's easy stuff. And I used to get scared. I used to get scared when I was early in sobriety of reading the chapter 5. They read it almost every meeting in the country. And it talks a lot about honesty, rigorous honesty. And people who don't seem to get sober seem to be constitutionally incapable of being honest. And even people with grave emotional and mental disorders can get sober if they have the capacity to be honest. Oh, not just regular honesty, rigorous honesty. Because I'm not an honest guy. So many times in my life I've lied when the truth would serve me better, you know. And I thought, I don't know if I'm honest enough. You know what? Let me tell you something. I just turned 20. On June 7th of this year, I turned 20 years sober. Don't clap. I wouldn't clap for years. Don't drink and don't die. You know, I'm glad to have. Actually, I was never so impressed with anybody's 20-year birthday as I was on my own. I lie. You know, Penny was talking about that earlier, you know, although she does something about it. I just go ahead and lie. But I related to what she said because I only do it when I'm divinely directed. You know, if my wife says to me, sweetheart, does this dress make me look fat? Rigorous honesty. Yeah. No, baby, you know what? I think it's the Haagen-Dazs. Yeah, you know. Yeah, the dress looked okay on the hanger, you know. Let's go try it on a skinny blonde next door. If it makes her look fat, then it's a dress, but I don't think so. See, that's rigorous stupidity. You don't got to do that. I lie to waiters all the time. I let waiters say, sir, would you like a cocktail before dinner? I say, no, thank you. You know, it's like a big deal. You know, I'm not going to go to hell for that. The waiter doesn't need to know. You know, rigorous honesty. Boy, you know what? There's a part of me deep down inside, I'd like to have a double Bushmills neat and a margarita back. How you like that? Yeah, keep them coming, pal. I got a pocket full of plastic. You know? No, hey, come here, come here. Don't do it. I'm just kidding you. Actually, I have a disease. I have an illness. Yeah, it's a mental obsession coupled with a physical allergy. You don't want, and spiritual bankruptcy. How'd you like to have that in your nice restaurant, pal? And I found out that people misquote the big book. They don't do it on purpose, you know, but every day in AA, somebody with some considerable time will misquote the big book. In fact, there's a good chance I did it tonight. I know I quoted the book a couple of times, and I may have got some words wrong. And if it bothers anybody, give me a call, 818-353-4607. 818-353-4607. Tell me where I misquoted it. I get those calls sometimes. But because I don't ever do it on purpose. But if I know I'm doing it, or if I wonder if I'm doing it, I'll say, I don't know if this is right. Or some people will say, and my opinion is. But when I was new, I didn't read the book. My sponsor didn't tell me to read the book right away. So when I read, I like to read something interesting, you know. So I don't want to read this book, but people quote the important stuff all the time in meetings, and a lot of times they'll give you page numbers too. So I thought, hey, I got a pretty good memory. You know, if enough people quote things out of the book, I'll get all the important stuff along with some page numbers, and people will think I read the book. It was a pretty good plan, except that I didn't know people misquote the book. So this woman said, she said, our book says that our drinking was but a symptom of deeper underlying causes and conditions. Which it does say that, you know. And that's not an exact quote, but the book says that. But what it doesn't say is what she said next. So, if you don't find your deeper underlying cause and condition, you are going to get drunk again. Doesn't say anything remotely like that, but if you're not reading the book, how the hell would you know? So, I'm counting on her, and I'm getting scared because I have no idea what my deeper underlying cause and condition was. I know when I had my first drink, I was 18 years old. I had friends that drank. I didn't drink with them. I didn't care about drinking. I was not interested in it at all. Wasn't much drinking went on in my family. My dad was the kind of guy who would buy a six-pack of beer, drink one, and put five in the fridge. Leave them there, you know, and that kind of drinking makes me sick. And my mom, I don't know, my mom actually may be an alcoholic. You can't really tell because she won't drink. And, you know, I mean, maybe so. I asked her one time, how come you don't drink? And she said, what do you care? I said, well, this, you know, are you an alcoholic? I mean, there's such a thing as a genetic predisposition. It may be your fault I'm a drunk. How about that? And she said, well, I don't know. I don't know. Maybe when I was young, I drank, and every time I drank, I got sick, stupid, and obnoxious, so I quit. I said, "You got to drink through that, Mom." You know, she doesn't have the tenacity to make this program. My first drink, a guy said, if you want to, I was going out with this girl, and we were in high school, and things were getting advanced, but I didn't know how to go to the next step. And he said, if you want to have sex with her, get her drunk. So I, you know, stole the bottle of Rainier Ale, which was a national beverage of Garden Grove, California, where I grew up. And I went there, and I would have been happy to say, here, drink this and let me know when you're ready, you know. But it just seemed kind of rude, so I drank some, she drank some, we passed it back and forth until we killed the bottle, and we both got a buzz on. You know, I'm not going to stand here and tell you, hey, a half a quart of Rainier Ale will take you downtown. You're all alcoholics, but if you're 17 or 18 years old and you drink your first half a bottle of Rainier Ale, it works. It gets your attention. And turned out my friend was right. You know, it was the first time I got drunk and the first time I ever had sex in front of a witness. So, you know, I just said, I made up my mind to talk about commitments in here. I committed. I said, I'm going to do this as much as I can the rest of my life. And, but I don't know what my deeper underlying cause and condition was. So I'm looking because I'm scared I'm going to get drunk again. And then I thought, oh, yeah. When I was 24, I moved from Orange County up to Hollywood, California to try to make a living in the music business. I had some friends up there in the music business, and so I would get a job like playing guitar with somebody or singing backup or sell a song or co-write a song or, you know, play harmonica on somebody's album. And I was starting to get a foothold, and there was a show that came to Los Angeles, came to Hollywood called Hair. It was a Broadway show about hippies singing and dancing and, you know, sex, drugs, and rock and roll. And I was like a famous musical, and so it came to Hollywood, and I went to see it. And it was like great. It was like this a musical comedy about me and my friends, and I was like knocked out. But there was a character named Berger that swung on a rope and stripped down to a loincloth, and you know ran over the audience, spare change people, obnoxious speed freak, sex crazed leader of the tribe. I said I could do that, and so I called him. I called the Aquarius Theater the next day. I said, hey. I saw your show last night. Oh, well, thanks for calling. I said, yeah, I want to be in it. I'd like to be in it. They said, what's your name? I said, Doug Rao. What are you doing Friday at 1 o'clock? I said, you tell me. See, like, this couldn't happen now. Now, if this happened, they'd say, well, who represents you? And please have your agent call us. But 69 was just a funny kind of period, you know, and for music. And so They said, Friday at 1 o'clock, you got an audition. Bring some sheet music. So I'm excited about it. I got some sheet music. Friday morning, I got my guitar out. I'm playing this sheet music, the song I'm going to sing, and I broke a string on my guitar. And, you know, it's hard to explain now, but hippies were like, oh, bad karma, dude. You know, so I went to the... Went to my roommate's room to see if he had the string that I needed, and right in the middle of his dresser was this little envelope. It's a D string on it. Ah, good karma, dude. So I picked that up, and underneath it was a little white capsule. You wonder what that is. Oh, because we didn't have a PDR. You pretty much had to swallow test everything. But, and it's a very effective test, actually. Forget about... You know, motor vehicles and heavy machinery, if you swallow it, you know what it's going to do. So, and if somebody dies, you know, don't eat the green shit. I mean, it's real simple stuff. So this turned out to be THC, a synthetic marijuana, and a nice little psychedelic. So by the time I got down to the Aquarius Theater, I was floating. I was flying, and my hair was long over my shoulders, and it just swished when I walked, you know, and... I had had these hip hugger bell bottoms on, real low hip huggers with bell bottoms about that big, you know, boom, 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 and I was about 50 pounds younger, and I had no shirt on, just a vest with six layers of foot long red, white, and blue leather fringe. Ooh, I was a walking wind chime, you know, and walked in there and with my sheet music, and I stood at the back of the theater, and I watched these hippies audition, and I'm going, I forgot what I was there for. Man, these hippies sing and dance. Yeah. And they're playing, and then somebody said, Doug Rowell, is Doug Rowell here? And I, yeah. So come on up. So I went up on stage, and I handed my sheet music to the piano player, and he looks at me, and he opens it up, big smile, and he winks, and he starts to play. Bum, 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 bum. I said, wow, I feel good. I went into this James Brown number, and I thought I was the godfather of soul, you know. I'm down on one knee and back up. And when I hold you, you know. and I see them nudging each other. You know. And so I finish, you know, wow, bah, 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 wow. And they said, great, man, great. We love your energy. Can you do something a little mellower so we kind of get a range? You bet. I didn't expect that, but I was right. I went into an a cappella version of Otis Redding's Dock of the Bay, you know. And I left my home in Georgia. Piano player picked it up, and we were right in the pocket, man. I made myself cry. And... It looks like nothing's going to change, you know. And they said, yeah, they're nudging. Yeah, man, yeah. So I finished, and I figured maybe I sing good enough they won't want me to dance. No. Because I never dance. I don't know anything about dancing. I'm the guy up on stage watching people dance, you know. So I know what good dancing looks like. I never tried it. So they said, cool, man, we just got to see you dance. I said, great, play. And the guy started playing, and I started moving around, you know, and I see these trails of my hair. Shoo! And the fringe on this vest is... It's like a laser light show. And I heard somebody say, Jesus, can he dance? Yeah. Because you know what I'm talking about. Alcohol and drugs will do for us what we cannot do for ourselves. And they hired me on the spot, but not for the L.A. show. They hired me to go to Las Vegas to understudy the lead role. And so I went there into Las Vegas, and I understudied the lead role for a while, and it was great, and all these hippies, and I was living there with a bunch of eight hippies living in this ranch house out in the professional area of Las Vegas. And then they took that show. I was there for 6 months, and then they took that show on the road, and I ended up playing the lead role, the lead role of Berger, the obnoxious speed freak, sex-crazed leader of the tribe. It was a stretch, you know, but I could do it. And we toured the United States and Canada for 3 years, and people would come up to us after the show up on stage and go, you're beautiful, man. have some pot, brother. Send some in. Maui, Wowie, Panama Red, Acapulco Gold, you know. Cool, thanks. Somebody goes, you like acid, man? Here, Osley, Purple Haze, Orange Sunshine, Window Pane, hey, 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 hey. And, got a witness, and, and, you know, and then it'd be like, while I was on the tour, that was the first time I tasted Jack Daniels. And old number seven, fell in love again. And but I look back at this experience from my newfound sobriety, and I realized that I had, you know, been victimized. And so I called my, because, you know, you don't know when you're doing it, you know, how they used me. And so I called my sponsor, and I said, hey, Jim, I found it. And he said, well, what'd you find now? I said, I was always finding stuff. He said, I said, my deeper underlying cause and condition. Oh, let's hear that. I said, hair. Oh, hair. He said, oh, you want to cut your hair? No, not. Remember, I don't know if you remember I told you I was a big star, I traveled around the country and everything. Oh, yeah, yeah. I forgot about the big star deal. Yeah. Yeah, he said, I'll tell you what, most people, he said, you were loaded when you auditioned for that show, though. I realized I told him too much, and I said, yeah, and he said, let me tell you something. Most people, when they go to interview for a job that they really want, won't take a drug they can't identify. And I got it. I heard that, and I had no argument for that. I said, well, then I don't know what my deeper underlying cause is. And condition is, maybe I'll get drunk. And he said, I guarantee you will if you swallow alcohol. So don't swallow any alcohol and go to a meeting tomorrow and call me tomorrow. And I want you to start reading that book tomorrow. What do you mean start reading the book? Start reading the book. Start reading the book. Read the book tomorrow. Not the whole thing. If you can't read a chapter, read a page. If you can't read a page, read a paragraph. You got the rest of your life to recover, but you got to stay in the middle of it. Great advice. I still believe to this day it's the best advice I ever got. Because if you keep reading that book, you will keep reading that book. If you can't read a chapter, read a page. If you can't read a page, read a paragraph. And you will read that book and read that book. And it's just like they say about going into a bar. You know, if you go to the barbershop long enough, you'll get a haircut. If you read that book long enough, read those directions, eventually you're going to take these steps and realize that taking the steps gives you a way to live happily and comfortably without drinking. Happily and comfortably without drinking. That's what we do here. And I never did find my deeper underlying cause and condition. I'm not interested in finding it. I finally settled on trauma from circumcision. I don't know, you know. It's far enough back. I don't have to worry. If it happened today, I'd be a little restless, irritable, and discontented. But I gotta get off of here. And I have had so much fun with you this afternoon. I've had fun from the moment the plane landed in Nashville, and I intend to keep having fun here, and I intend to come back. I love all of you very much. And if you're new here tonight and you're wondering what the hell is this guy talking about the music of Alcoholics Anonymous, I think it's the laughter. I really think the laughter is the music. It's the magic. It's the thing that makes the words make sense, you know. We come in here sick unto death and dying and feeling like we'll never laugh again. And I can't tell you how many people I've heard say, I was sitting in the room feeling like I'd never laugh again, and I heard somebody laughing and realized it was me. It was me, you know, and you gave me the laughter, and it's my great pleasure to give it back to you. And if you shared a laugh with us today, you are in the band, man. You're part of the music. Thanks a lot. Wow.